Scientists used to scoff at reports of 100-foot waves, because without data, waves like that violated the very rules of physics. But today, the science of mammoth waves is a hot field of study, relevant to everyone living on our very watery planet. In her new book, The Wave, Susan Casey meets legendary big wave surfer Laird Hamilton and writes about the ship Discovery, which played a key role in our understanding of giant waves.
They set out in February 2000 into the North Atlantic on a fairly typical research cruise. It would take them about 3 weeks, and they would sail up the coast of the UK to Scotland and then across to Iceland and take water samples for salinity, for temperature, various water readings, because one of the things that scientists are most concerned about with climate change is what is that going to do to the ocean circulation that delivers the heat, you know, to Western Europe that makes basically the climate moderate there. They're trying to figure that out. You know, we haven't been observing the weather or the oceans in any kind of concerted way for, I don't know, more than 30 years because satellites came along in 1980. So this was really important work, but it was very different than what they ended up doing. And what happened was they got into a series of storms, six back-to-back-to-back storms, and they were prevented from doing their work, and they were had their bow of the ship pointed into the waves because that's the only safe position. I mean, the ship doesn't want to get broadside to the waves, or it certainly doesn't want to have the waves behind it and get swamped. So they were just there, stuck in these waves, these 30, 40-foot waves. And then it looked like maybe things were getting better, and the weather forecasts and wave forecasts that they were looking at said, hey, yeah, you know, things might be getting better. And then that night, they were hit with an onslaught of waves that were fantastically huge, 60, 70, 80, 90, even approaching 100 feet tall. For almost 2 days, they were walloped by these unpredicted giant waves, and all the furniture was flying around, and the windows broke, the ship was twisting. People were really freaking out, and it was a very tenuous situation. They managed to get back to Southampton, and they managed to get all the data off the ship because it had a wave recorder. It had all these instruments around it, so they knew exactly what had happened to the ship. They could then compare it to the models, the weather models, the predictions that they had gotten that said that there is no way that 100-foot waves should be around. So that paper came out in 2006, and it was a really big deal because what all these models are used for all shipping, all recreational boating, and that goes a long way towards explaining why so many ships are lost, and it's a really huge number.
I think these are hard to understand. I mean, I was standing on the shore in Cape Cod just a little while ago, and I was saying, oh, what nice big waves are pounding on the shore. They were probably 6 feet high, and I thought they were big waves. You're talking about something that's almost unimaginable by comparison.
I don't think there's anything scarier. And at one point in the book, I saw a 70-foot wave from very close range. And when they get above 50 feet or 55 feet, they start doing something very different. And that is they really become vertical. They're like an advancing wall of water. I think the special effects people on the movie The Perfect Storm did a very good job of indicating that weird verticality that happens when a wave gets really, really big and this feathering that happens at the top, which is quite harrowing to look at because you see it winding up. It's like somebody pulling their arm back to punch you, but it's really slow, but you know they're going to do it, and it's bigger and bigger. And there's nothing you can do to get away from it. These are super powerful. We saw how powerful in 2004 when the tsunami hit in Indonesia. And it was like, what do you mean a wave killed 250,000 people? I mean, it's just, even a wave your own height can kill you.
You talk about these waves very vividly. Have you seen them personally? Have you seen one of these monster waves close up?
I moved to Hawaii to spend time with this group of surfers that were all trying to chase these giant waves down, and I traveled with them all over the world in pursuit of them, and I went into the waves with them on jet skis.
You met a man named Laird Hamilton, and I guess the way you describe meeting him gives some perspective on these waves as well. You said he looks like a very, very big man when you're talking to him, until you see him in a wave.
Well, he is. He's 6'3", and he has, when he's on an 80-foot wave, obviously, he's in a position that he refers to as Ant-Man.
This has to have been new to you. You were excited by it. You were looking for the waves. You were thrilled by the notion that he was riding them. Was it hard for you to decide that you were going to go out and feel what those waves felt like?
No, because that's what my goal was in writing the book. My goal was to take readers to the top of a 100-foot wave, or as close as I could get, and explain to them what it was like. Because if you think about it, you know, 1,900 people have been to the top of Everest, but who has been to the top of a 100-foot wave and come back to talk about it? Not very many. So from the get-go, that was the arrangement, that I would go out with him, and I moved to Maui, where this wave called Jaws exists off the north shore of Maui. And every time there was a very big day at Jaws, I would go out. I would either go out with Laird or another surfer or the cameraman, or I would go in the helicopter, that their safety helicopter that flies above the wave. But the thing is, those days are pretty rare. They might come along one, two, three times a season. So I started doing that in 2005. And then I went to a number of other waves with other surfers, including Mavericks off the coast of California near Half Moon Bay, and Todos Santos, which is a wave called Killers, down off the coast of Ensenada, and most notably, I think, outside of Hawaii, to a wave called Te Ahupo in Tahiti, which is considered to be the most dangerous wave in the world for big wave riders and has taken a number of lives. And that was a wave that Laird was very famous for riding under conditions that nobody thought could be ridden. And he took me into that wave as well on a jet ski in a situation where, you know, I was very aware that if something had gone wrong with the machine or if something had gone wrong with the conditions, if the wave had done something weird or if I had fallen off, that I probably wouldn't have survived it.
So tell me about a day, any day. Pick a day when you went out with Laird. You got on the jet ski. You knew that the big wave was coming. By this time, I guess you could predict when it was likely to be there. You couldn't know for sure. What do you do?
When they go to surf the big waves, and the waves that they surf, the big ones, are different than the rogue waves that are taking out ships. These waves come as a result of big storms. Usually when they hit Hawaii, it's the result of a big storm that brewed in the Gulf of Alaska and kind of came down at a certain angle and a certain velocity and hit a bottom feature, either a big reef or, in one case, a submerged mountain range. It needs to be quite deep water, and the feature needs to be quite big to create a giant wave. So on a day like that, they kind of know it's coming a few days out. Not always, but that gives them enough time to get on a plane if they need to. So a lot of, if let's say there was a big day at Jaws in Maui, a lot of surfers would have come from California. Some might have even come from South Africa. Some might have come from the South Pacific. Some might have come from Australia. They would have all converged there if the storm had been big enough, had produced what I refer to as a magenta blob on the weather radar maps, and they would be there, and you would see them pouring into the airport with all their camera equipment and surfing equipment, and you would see all the jet skis being worked on the night before, and you would sense a kind of frenetic energy in the air and a certain kind of nervousness. And then the next morning, they're out before dawn, and you just, when there's a swell that's going to create a 70 or 80-foot wave, there's just a huge amount of water moving around. It's like you're in the same ocean, but it's a completely different ocean. So you go into the marina, and the water could be coming over the top of the pier. You know, like it's just, the water is really powerful because this energy has come in. And so then somehow we make it out to the wave. There's different ways. So you might have a boat that would sit in a channel close to the wave, or there might be just kind of a number of jet skis that would hold photographers. The surfers operate in teams. There's a driver and a rider, and the rider has a water ski tow rope, and the driver pulls him onto the wave, and then the surfer lets go, because if a wave is over 40 feet tall, it can't be paddled into. It's just moving too fast. You know, it's like trying to merge into the highway on your bicycle or something. So on a day like that, you know, and the sun would come up, and you see these waves, you know, they're really humbling. There's just nothing you can think about how powerful you are in the face of a 60 or 70-foot wave. And generally, the day will go on and people will ride. There's never more than one rider on a wave, 60 or 70 or 80-foot wave, because it's too dangerous.
Where do these waves come from? You talked about coming from all over the world. Do they live anywhere? Is there a sort of common source to them?
The energy, the wind that is created by the weather would be, I think, the most common source of giant storm waves. That's really, the energy is pumped into the water from the wind. So the more volatile a storm, the more energy that's in a storm, the more energy it can transfer into the water, and thus, you know, the bigger the waves can get. You know, giant storm waves can happen anywhere, but there are places in the world where the wind blows over long stretches of ocean or, you know, with uninterrupted by land masses. And those places tend to create the biggest waves, like the belt of water around Antarctica is one of them. And the North Sea, the area that the Discovery was in from Scotland to Iceland, that's another long, they call it a fetch, a distance that the wind can, you know, blow unimpeded and create waves. And anywhere there's a long fetch, you can get giant waves.
So people are clearly beginning to believe in them now. I mean, some people always did. The data that was recovered from the survival of Discovery, did that start a new wave, if you will, of research into these giant monster waves?
There definitely is a lot of interest in waves right now, especially big waves. And I would say that what caused it, there were a couple things. The tsunami definitely impacted the sense that we didn't know enough or weren't aware of the geohistory of tsunamis enough. Like, we were really taken by surprise by that one and possibly shouldn't have been, because it's a regular feature of the oceans. And if you, they core into the seabed and they can tell when the tsunamis happen by various layers of things that they find. So tsunami research got an influx of energy after that. And then the other thing that really impacted wave research was Katrina. The storm surge that inundated New Orleans made everybody clear that there's, you know, A, the power, and B, the vulnerability. And one of the chapters in the book, I go to a wave conference where the scientists are really fretting about what we don't know about giant storm surges and storm waves, and also asking themselves the question whether this is going to become more of a problem due to climate change. And the answer that the scientists gave me, all the ones that I spoke to, was yes, absolutely.
Susan Casey is the editor-in-chief of O Magazine and the author of The Wave.